I next met with Dr. Rod Ramchandran from the Barbara Ann Karmanos Cancer Institute in Detroit. And to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
This is a young man. He was in his usual state of health until he developed some respiratory symptoms. He was told that he had an upper respiratory infection, which is not uncommon in this setting. And he was treated with antibiotics, developed progressive symptoms with night sweats, and ultimately ended up having a CAT scan, which showed a mediastinal mass and adenopathy above and below the diaphragm. He had stage 3 disease with retroperitoneal, splenic, and mediastinal and cervical adenopathy as well. So he, interestingly, was in the medical field, not at my institution, but he was aware of clinical trials and had actually inquired about the Echelon study when this came about. And so we had a long discussion about considering clinical study versus standard therapy, which at that time remained ABVD. So after this discussion, he was interested in the study and was randomized to the brentuximab vedotin AVD arm.
So before we get into what happened to him, I'd like to kind of take a step back and use his presentation to talk about, before we kind of get into the Echelon study, a little bit about some of the issues in patients presenting similar to this patient. So I guess one question would be, when you look at a patient like this, what are some of the key things that you consider in terms of prognosis? How long ago was it, incidentally, that this happened?
Yeah, so I believe he was diagnosed in 2013.
So that's 5 years ago. At that point, was response-adapted ABVD being done?
Not routinely, no. I mean, there was some early data suggesting a potential benefit, but that was not a standard at that time.
Interesting. So can you talk about, when you looked at his case globally, from your point of view, what the prognosis was, let's say, with ABVD or even at this point with response-adapted ABVD, and what are some of the key variables you consider when you look at patients' prognoses?
Typically, patients with advanced stage disease who are older have a poorer outcome, high LDH, low albumin, hemoglobin less than 10, an absolute lymphocyte count below 0.8. These are all things that are used to calculate the IPS score, which has been developed by the German Hodgkin Study Group to prognosticate patients into low, intermediate, and high-risk patients based on a score of 1 to 7. The age of patients over 45 has been quoted as a high-risk feature. Male sex has been quoted as a high-risk feature. As I said, leukocytosis and a hemoglobin less than 10, so a leukocytosis of greater than 15,000.
What about histopathology? This patient was a mixed cellularity subtype. Does that factor in?
Yeah, so historically, histopathology has been a mechanism to prognosticate patients. That has become actually less important, I think, as time has gone on. We treat patients similarly. Lymphocyte predominant and nodular sclerosing patients have historically done better, but I don't necessarily feel that other subtypes will do worse or change my therapy based on the subtype of classical Hodgkin's lymphoma. The one subtype I would say that should be considered is nodular lymphocyte predominant Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is not a typical classical Hodgkin's lymphoma, with a different immunophenotype, which is CD20 positive, typically CD30 negative, and can be treated differently than classical Hodgkin's lymphoma and has a different clinical behavior and relapse pattern.
So I'm just kind of curious, in this patient's situation, what would you estimate his risk of relapse would be with the ABVD or response-adapted ABVD?
Let me take that in two steps. The first would be ABVD. So if you calculate his risk, he had, I think, 4 adverse prognostic features on the IPS criteria. And based on that, his cure rate with ABVD alone would range between 65 to 75%. Conversely, if we look at risk-adapted strategies, these often incorporate PET scans. And historically, we've seen positive PET findings to have a very poor outcome in advanced stage patients. Interestingly, as time has gone on, and the Echelon study was, I think, in part very important in understanding this, PET positive patients have done somewhat better than what had historically been reported. Originally, PET positivity was thought to predict an outcome of progression-free survival or relapse-free survival of less than 20% and many times less than 15%. But if you look, for example, in the PET positive patients in the Echelon study and other studies, the outcomes with ABVD are closer to 40 to 50%. Progression-free survival. So PET positivity certainly predicts a worse outcome and should be considered, but whether it actually is as bad as originally thought is important to consider when making your calculation about how to proceed. That being said, patients who have PET positivity do worse certainly than those who have PET negativity, and there are now a few different studies that have looked at dose escalations to BIACOP in that population. I think it's important to note that dose-escalated BIACOP has not been widely accepted by community and even academic oncologists because of the toxicity profile associated with it, not only cytopenias, but also secondary malignancies and infertility. But in those studies, the important thing is they've been fairly consistent in improving the progression-free survival about 20% or into the 60 to 70% range, suggesting there is potentially a benefit in patients who are PET positive. I'm also cautious to say that not all PET positivity is the same. So you have some patients that have a great deal of residual disease, and then those with one or two lymph nodes. And biologically, I think it's important to consider that when you consider changing therapy based on a PET scan.
So we're doing a project. I don't know if you ever are familiar with Adjuvant Online, which was an online program in breast. I mean, it was also in colon and lung, but people knew it for breast. That probably familiar with the Adjuvant Online model that was done. You put in patient factors. It gives you risk of relapse, survival. Actually, it's not even up anymore. Our group, we're trying to do a project like that right now. And it really has us thinking a lot about numeracy, okay? So you said this patient was in the medical field, so maybe even more able to understand data. If a patient like this, or maybe even this patient, said to you, look, I know it's just your best estimate, but could you tell me what you think is my baseline risk of relapse if I take traditional ABVD? What's my risk of relapse if I take response-adapted ABVD? Because as you said, maybe by capturing some of the PET positivity, it might even be a little better. And what's my chance of relapse under your hands if I take bevacizumab AVD? What numbers would you give to the patient?
It's an interesting question. When you take a patient with advanced stage disease, in general, in the absence of risk factors, I would say his cure rate would be somewhere between 80 to 90%. However, with each additional risk factor, you lose a certain percentage. And at some point, it's not a linear curve. So I'm loath to say that each risk factor adds a certain percentage, but that is how the studies were done to look at this and suggest that roughly a 5 to 10% drop per risk factor, though I'd have to look at that actually honestly very carefully to make sure that I'm not misspeaking and what level that is. So there's also the notion that that has changed over time. Those risk factors were developed in the 90s. In patient populations that were treated slightly differently than they are today.
I'm actually not asking you from the point of view of clinical science.
Okay.
I'm asking you as a clinician.
Mm-hmm.
In this breast cancer project, we're doing the same exact thing because the numbers for what we're asking are just not out there. You know, there is no perfect data. But what we're saying to them is, what would you say to a patient? And that's what I'm saying to you. As somebody who had this clinical situation came to you today, same age, same situation, and they said, look, I know you don't know the perfect answer, but what's your best estimate? And of course, in Hodgkin, if you relapse, it doesn't mean you're not cured. But let's just talk about relapse, because that leads down a whole other path. If a patient with this situation said, what's my risk of relapse? What's your best estimate? What number would you give them for these three alternatives or range of numbers?
Right. So I would approximate for standard ABVD therapy a 70 to 75% risk of cure. That is to say, treatment-free, relapse-free survival moving forward. If you take this patient and just put them in the context of the study, that number came out to about 77%, which is a little bit higher than what I think we would have predicted. With AAVD, the only data we have is based on the study itself. And based on that, we would say the result would be somewhere between 80 to 85% in this setting. So a 5% benefit, roughly, for the addition of brentuximab, vedotin, and omission of bleomycin.
Okay, so what about response-adapted ABVD? And again, I know these numbers aren't perfect, but just what would you say to the patient?
So again, response-adapted requires knowing what the PET is. So I think the best way to tell you that is based on a negative PET or a positive PET. So if we have a PET scan that's negative, your cure rate increases to close to 90% with ABVD. With PET positivity, with ABVD, that number would go down to about 40 to 50%. And if one considered escalated BICOP, the data suggests that your progression-free survival would be in the 60 to 70% range.
Well, but I'm talking about at the beginning, before you know what the PET, the patient's going to, I guess you sort of could wait to provide those numbers after you see, but if the patient's trying to decide to go down the response-adapted ABVD approach or BVAVD, so globally, do you think still with, I mean, again, we have no way of knowing because Echelon didn't look at this, do you think you would see an advantage in progression-free survival or relapse-free survival? Would you give the same numbers to the patient, or would you say, I think it's a little higher?
In the absence of knowing what the PET would show, the majority of patients will be PET negative. But that 70 to 75% number is what we would provide, trying to calculate what the PET positivity rate would be and the PET negativity rate would be. So you try to do that in the original estimation of 70 to 75% with ABVD, assuming ABVD all along, because you don't plan on escalating to be a cop in the vast majority of patients. So I think it's difficult to do that without knowing if you're going to use risk-adapted therapy or not, because the majority of patients actually won't be treated that way in all comers. So I think that number, 70 to 75%, relates to this entire population. Now, if you're PET positive after two cycles, then you can look at the data based on escalation or de-escalation. On the other hand, if you're looking at risk-adapted therapy or AAVD, those numbers are from the beginning. If you look at after the PET scan, I think then you have a more precise delineation of those patients.
So I think maybe you see where I'm heading because, again, I know breast cancer is completely different, but there's a whole numeracy out there in how people view minimal increases. And again, here we're not necessarily talking about in breast cancer, you have metastatic disease and it's not curable. One other issue that I hear a lot from general medical oncologists who don't see anywhere near the number of cases that people in academic centers is a real concern about bleomycin. And I'm curious, you know, they just can't predict it. Most of them have had a case. How much is that abrogated by using response-adapted ABVD? Do you still see sporadic cases of severe pulmonary toxicity?
Yeah, so in patients who were on, let's say, for example, the RAFL study, in which PET negative patients had the omission of bleomycin, the omission of bleomycin was statistically significant and beneficial in terms of pulmonary events when you compare the ABVD arm versus the bleomycin omission arm. And that we certainly can see occasional cases in the first two cycles. The predictability of bleomycin-related lung toxicity is not an easy thing, and it can occur even with the first cycle. And it can occur 6 months after completion of therapy. So it is not a predictable toxicity. However, it does appear that the omission of bleomycin after two cycles of ABVD, if you are PET negative, suggests that those patients have a significantly lower rate, and in fact, a very low rate of pulmonary toxicity compared to patients who get six cycles of bleomycin with their therapy.
Another issue I wanted to ask you about, because certainly response-adaptive therapy is really a great strategy, but is the question of quality of PET scanning and PET scanning interpretation. There's some situations in the community where the PET scanner's kind of out in the parking lot in a van or something. I don't know the exact quality of the readers. How much of an issue is this from a really practical point of view? Is it really doesn't really matter or does it actually matter?
Well, it doesn't matter if you don't change therapy based on what the findings are. But certainly if you are changing therapy based on the result of a PET scan, then it is very clinically meaningful. The variability in PET scan readership, even among very good radiologists, has been noted. The Deauville scoring system, which should be standard, I believe, in the reading of lymphoma, has tried to mitigate this with internal controls and variations in glucose. But still, there are differences between what individual radiologists and the quality of scanners will provide. There is a certain false positivity rate of PET scans as well, which is important because if you are considering escalating patients to, say, BICOP or even in some cases transplant, in young patients like this, you really should be very certain that this is disease and not a false positive PET. And that gets back to the point that PET positivity is variable as well. There are some patients with a single isolated region that is PET positive and those with 10 residual lesions that remain PET positive, which is much more convincing, in my opinion, for refractory disease. So I think that there is a clinical variation in how one interprets the data, but there's also a radiologic variability that must be taken into account.
So another issue in the upfront decision-making is obviously complications and toxicity. And again, an educated patient in the medical field, for example, like this patient, says to you, you know, based on the way you, at this point, the experience you have using these different regimens, what can you tell me about what I might experience? I'm particularly curious about bevacizumab AVD in terms of risk of neutropenia and neutropenia-related problems under your hands, and you can talk about growth factors, et cetera, as well as peripheral neuropathy, particularly the possibility or likelihood that it'll be permanent or have to significantly impact on the treatment. Just from a clinical point of view, what would you say to the patient?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of very good points here. I think the use of growth factor with ABVD has been noted to increase the risk of potential pulmonary toxicity. And also the rate of febrile neutropenia with ABVD is relatively low compared to other regimens that cause this degree of neutropenia. So in general, with ABVD, we do not recommend growth factor support. In sharp contrast to this, the AAVD regimen had a significantly higher rate of febrile neutropenia, about 20%, which is more than double what you would see with ABVD. And because of that, midway through the Echelon study, they recommended use of growth factor support with primary prophylaxis. That being said, this was something we learned as we went through the study. This was not known going into this. And when I participated in the study and the vast majority of the investigators, we didn't use primary growth factor prophylaxis with AAVD. And it actually makes things very confusing because now you have two potential platform therapies, one that in which we recommend growth factor support and the other in which we strongly recommend not to use growth factor support. And keeping those things in mind is important, not only because of financial considerations, but they can have significant detrimental effects to the patient if done incorrectly.
So what about peripheral neuropathy?
Yeah, so not unexpectedly, AAVD had significantly higher rates of peripheral neuropathy, including grade 2 and grade 3 peripheral neuropathy, which I think are both clinically meaningful findings. Grade 2 peripheral neuropathy includes difficulty with activities of daily living and or pain. So the majority of patients actually did have some level of neuropathy on the AAVD arm, and dose reductions and dose alterations were not uncommon. A proportion of patients were dose reduced, and it was recommended that if one had grade 2 neuropathy, that the dose of brentuximab vedotin per protocol was reduced to 0.9 milligrams per kilogram. Interestingly, there were different geographic considerations in how physicians address this. So there's not homogeneity even amongst experts about how to dose reduce and dose adjust these drugs in combination. That being said, the majority of patients who had doses withheld of brentuximab vedotin or dose reduced and had grade 2 or grade 3 neuropathy did improve upon cessation of treatment, though it can take several weeks. And not all of the patients have this resolve. There are some patients, for example, this patient in this narrative that continues to have grade 1 neuropathy even 5 years out.
So I was going to ask you to follow up on this patient. Can you talk about what happened in terms of the disease and what happened to him?
Yeah, so he had an excellent response to AAVD.
So he was randomized to the experimental arm, though?
He was randomized to the experimental arm with brentuximab, vedotin, AVD. And after two cycles of therapy, a PET scan showed that he was in complete remission. And after the third cycle, he developed grade 2 neuropathy, which required a dose reduction of his brentuximab, vedotin, to 0.9 milligrams per kilogram, which continued. He did eventually have, by the end of treatment, a reduction in his neuropathy to grade 1. But most troubling for him, he was a physician, but he was also a musician. And he had difficulty during the course of treatment fingering his keys on the saxophone and playing the piano, which was very important to him. So there was consideration and discussion of whether we would hold the dose of brentuximab vedotin. But as his neuropathy did improve with the dose reduction, we were able to continue it for the 6 cycles. And now he continues to have grade 1 neuropathy, but overall he's able to function well and continues to play his instruments. He has had 2 children since completion of therapy, and it has been now 5 years, as you have noted. And so he is considered cured of his Hodgkin's lymphoma and is doing very well, actually.
Could you describe more specifically exactly what symptoms he has of the neuropathy at this point, and how does it affect his musician activities?
Yeah, so, you know, neuropathy can be difficult to discern and grade in clinical practice. My instinct is if you have any difficulties with daily living, for example, zippering zippers, buttoning buttons, tying shoes, these are things that I commonly ask my patients on brentuximab vedotin to gauge what their level of neuropathy is, because oftentimes patients will not consider these changes in their practice necessarily significant, but they can herald a progressive neuropathy, which is better to be identified early on. In this particular patient's case, he had neuropathy both in his fingers and his toes, as well as actually a patch of numbness in his right thigh, which developed after the 3rd cycle, which was a little bit unusual. This numbness, when he was fingering keys, I believe on a saxophone, made it difficult for him to identify the individual lever to push, if I'm using the terminology correctly. I'm not a saxophone player, obviously. And often his fingers would slip off the levers as he played. So his playing became worse, and it was noticeable to him. And when I examined him, he did have some difficulty buttoning his buttons. Sometimes what I do is I put a coin on the table and ask him to pick it up without sliding it off. And I noticed that he had difficulty doing that. Something that takes 1 second took him 5 to 10 seconds. So these were all indicative of grade 2 neuropathy in my view for him.
I'm curious, you know, you mentioned that he's a physician, so obviously he can see this through much more sophisticated eyes. But when he looks back on it, does he regret going on the trial or receiving this treatment? Or does he maybe view these symptoms as a trade-off for the possibility that he might have avoided a relapse he could have had on ABVDs? This, he would be able to understand that it seems, based on your numbers, maybe 1 out of 20 chance.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I asked him that question. I asked him a couple of different questions. I asked him why he went on trial in the first place. What made him choose the trial versus standard therapy? And then secondly, what did he think about the results? Because he read the paper when it came out. And how did he feel about that? Overall, actually, he was very satisfied with participating in the trial. And I think he felt that the neuropathy, while noticeable to him and difficult while he was on study, as it has improved to grade 1, he is comfortable with that. I think if it had persisted at grade 2, he may have had different thoughts. And that sort of highlights the importance of being proactive in addressing neuropathy. But that being said, with his neuropathy now quite minimal, and obviously the outcome of him doing well now for 5 years, he seems very comfortable and very happy with the decision. When I asked him why he went on the study, he really looked at the phase 2 data with brentuximab vedotin in the post-transplant setting and really felt that it was a very active drug. And that really swayed him to consider the study. And he actually hoped to be on the experimental arm when he was told about this.
That's really interesting. I can understand that completely. And it actually sort of played out that way. Maybe not as much as people hope, but it's still seemed like it did. And that's really interesting the way he viewed it. You know, another outcome in addition to being cured that's interesting that you mentioned here is the fact that he was able to have 2 children. I'm trying to remember if I've seen anything about fertility with AVD versus ABVD. Do we know anything about that?
Yeah, so I think that information is actively being collected, and we'll hopefully have that information. Obviously, fertility with females is easier to obtain than males in general. And there's often a lag time between completion of therapy and either resumption of fertility or obviously conception. What's interesting, I always find, is that these are obviously young patients, and the number of individuals that actually seek fertility harvesting is proportionately low compared to other diseases, for example, say testicular cancer and other things. But it's important to also note that ABVD doesn't have a very high incidence of infertility. Many patients come to me with a sense that they will be infertile with ABVD. But actually, it's less likely to be true. In fact, unlikely to be true. There was a large cohort analysis in Sweden, which looked at rates of infertility with ABVD versus a control population in a large number of patients. And after 3 years, there was very little difference between the control population in terms of birth rates compared to the ABVD arm. Obviously, that incidence is higher the older one is when they receive therapy, if they use alternative therapies like escalated via COP, and early on in therapy versus after 3 years. But it's interesting to note that while we always discuss fertility management with patients, we don't necessarily insist on patients having egg or sperm harvesting before treatment, particularly if they're symptomatic, and delaying therapy can have significant clinical implications.
So I want to get on to your next case, but just one more question about upfront therapy, and it relates to the older patient. And I was curious what you think about this comment that a prominent HL investigator made in one of our CME programs, which is, I do not use bleomycin in people over the age of 60. Agree or disagree?
So just to give you my approach to an older patient with Hodgkin's lymphoma, the first question I think needs to be asked is this patient a candidate for curative therapy? And whether that means AVD, ABVD, or a different regimen like Clavip is important. If they're at all a potential candidate for curative therapy, then I assess their risk for potential side effects with either bleomycin or anthracyclines, both of which can have issues as they get older. Assuming that they're relatively healthy, meaning no pulmonary problems and no cardiac problems, I don't remove ABVD from the discussion, particularly in the era of risk-adapted therapy where we're minimizing the role of bleomycin.
No age limit on that? Theoretically, if you have a 75-year-old, would you consider it?
I mean, I think I would consider it, but certainly as age increases, the risk of bleomycin toxicity increases. That being said, my cutoff, I think, is a little bit higher than 60. I think over 70, I would have severe concerns about giving bleomycin. But I think 61, 62, 63, otherwise healthy individuals can receive two cycles of bleomycin, and I'm comfortable with that.
What would you use it in a healthy 70-year-old, for example? What would you use? I hear people talking about AVD, which I think a lot of people did before Echelon. But obviously, you could also use BV-AVD. What do you generally use in that? You know, if you, I don't know how often you even see it, probably not too often.
Well, outcomes, it is not common, but certainly in my practice, you know, older individuals with Hodgkin's lymphoma do get sent to me. The balance you run with older patients is they have a higher rate of bleomycin lung toxicity. They also have poor outcomes with therapy to begin with. And so then there is a balance that one must consider weighing the potential risk of omitting drugs and their relapse rate versus the potential for lung toxicity of bleomycin. In a person who's older than 70 with advanced stage disease, that is to say disease which is stage 3 or 4 with significant risk factors, I would tend to lean towards AAVD currently to minimize the risk of lung toxicity, but also to potentially improve his chance of success. Outside of that, historically, I had used AVD or even Clavip, depending on his performance status, which has curative potential, which is chlorambucil, vinblastine, procarbazine, and prednisone. There is a study that Andy Evans has presented looking at brentuximab vedotin, and brentuximab vedotin alone was looked at patients over the age of 60. And while it's very active as a single agent, the durability of the drug was not as promising as I think I had hoped or others had hoped in the field. But in combination with either single-agent drugs, such as dacarbazine, for instance, or in the methodology used by Andy Evans, where he did a lead-in with two cycles of brentuximab vedotin in older patients, followed by AVD and then consolidation with brentuximab vedotin. What was important to note is the outcomes were relatively good. The toxicity profile was manageable. Obviously, there's no bleomycin in this regimen. The issues, I think, largely were with this, that it is a very long therapy. And only about half of the patients were able to complete the entirety of therapy, because you're looking at six cycles of AVD plus six total cycles of brentuximab vedotin. And that can be quite difficult from a duration of treatment. There was increased rates of peripheral neuropathy in older patients compared to younger patients, as well as neutropenia and febrile neutropenia. So those things need to be considered as well.
So one final question, and we could talk a long time about upfront therapy, but I did want to pick your brain a little bit about relapse disease and some other questions. But you mentioned, you used the word currently when you were talking before, and it made me think, what's your best guess, or what are you most excited about, or what we might be doing, let's say, 2 or 3 years from now?
I think the issue that we have right now, it's a confusing time for Hodgkin's. It's an exciting time, but very confusing in the sense that historically, we had a very sort of linear, dogmatic approach about early stage disease and advanced stage disease, with combined modality therapy for early stage disease using an ABVD or ABVD-like regimen, and six cycles of ABVD plus or minus radiation in the advanced stage setting. Now we have almost three different platforms in early stage disease, and in advanced stage disease, we have three different platforms. In early stage disease, you could look at three cycles of therapy and consideration of radiation or no radiation based on the RAPID study. You could consider two cycles of therapy followed by a PET scan, and then two cycles of therapy versus radiation based on the H10 study. And you still have the German Hodgkin's study group findings from the HD10 study, which looked at two cycles and 20 gray for early favorable patients. And I think it's also important to note that the RATHL study also had stage 2 patients. About 40% of patients were stage 2 in this study. And so the role of omitting bleomycin in PET negative patients with a total of six cycles also is in play in this setting. And they all individually use different risk stratification criteria. They all use different criteria as to what is PET positive and PET negative. And they all use different treatments. And comparisons become very difficult in that setting. So in the advanced setting, I think conversely, you have the echelon 1 data with AABD versus ABVD. You have risk-adapted strategies, which look at escalating to be a COP. And of course, you have ABVD alone. I think what ultimately, I hope to see, and I'm excited to see, is a remelding of these strategies to look at adding these novel agents in a risk-adapted strategy. For example, patients who have PET-positive disease get the addition of brentuximab vedotin or checkpoint inhibitors, or de-escalation from AAVD, for example, may be an option as well. So I think those are all interesting things and things that we are trying to sort out and figure out. We have a multitude of studies doing this in different ways. And I think the next 5 years in Hodgkin's lymphoma are going to be spent trying to incorporate these novel agents in a rational approach for patients, both with early stage disease and advanced stage disease.
You talked about using brentuximab vedotin or checkpoint inhibitor in patients with PET positivity, but what about both?
I think that's on the table. There's obviously no data in the frontline setting for combining these drugs right now together, but certainly in the relapse setting, we've seen both safety and tolerability of this combination. So I think for your high-risk patients that are PET positive, adding these drugs either as a non-chemotherapeutic approach to salvage patients or with chemotherapy may be very, very interesting.
Let's move on to talk about your second case. I'd like to see if we can get through the rest of your cases because they really look interesting. Now that we've sort of fleshed out upfront therapy a lot, maybe we can sort of just kind of touch into some of these other issues. So maybe you can talk a little bit about what happened, and actually it may harken back to our discussion about upfront therapy when we look at how this patient was initially managed. This 49-year-old man, what happened there?
Yeah, so this is a 49-year-old male who developed significant symptomatology with shortness of breath, actually was seen in the emergency room to rule out a pulmonary embolism. He has some mild comorbidities, some obesity, but no coronary artery disease or pulmonary disease. He does have hypertension. And when they evaluated him, they again found mediastinal adenopathy. It was not bulky, but further imaging, including a PET scan, showed that he had multiple bony lesions, and he did not have B symptoms. So he was staged as stage 4A disease. And we again met with him and talked to him about various treatment platforms for initial disease. And he elected to have risk-adapted therapy as his strategy. And he nicely had a response after two cycles with PET negativity. And based on this, we omitted bleomycin per the RAFL data for him. And he completed therapy approximately, I would say, about a year and a half ago. Unfortunately, shortly after completing therapy, within 3 months, and I think likely within 2 months, based on when he noticed a lymph node in his neck, he was found to have recurrent, or in this case, refractory Hodgkin's lymphoma. And this was biopsy proven. And he received two cycles of ICE chemotherapy, which has been our standard salvage regimen. But he did not achieve even a PR to this. He was then asked about clinical studies as well. And there was a study that was available that combined brentuximab vedotin and a checkpoint inhibitor nivolumab versus brentuximab vedotin alone. And he was interested in this. And my appeal for this for him was actually that he had demonstrated significant chemo refractoriness. And considering a non-chemotherapeutic approach made sense for him, I thought. And so this discussion led to him being randomized to the combination nivolumab and brentuximab vedotin arm. And impressively, within four cycles of treatment, and this is given every 3 weeks, he achieved a complete remission. He then went on to receive an autologous stem cell transplant, and he had significant risk factors, which would have made him potentially a consideration for the Athera study. It's important to note that in the Athera study, they looked at patients who were brentuximab vedotin naive, but risk factors included patients who had refractory disease, patients who relapsed within 1 year, and extranodal involvement. And he had at least two of these risk factors. And we discussed the Athera findings with him. And given his refractory nature, he was interested in receiving maintenance therapy with brentuximab vedotin. So to briefly touch on the Athera study, this was a study of over 300 patients that randomized patients post-autologous stem cell transplant who had not achieved a complete remission or had disease that had high-risk features, as I mentioned earlier, with disease which had relapsed within 1 year, had extranodal involvement, or primary refractory disease. To be honest with you, I had some concerns about the study when it was developed and the initial readouts came into play. A fair proportion of patients went into transplant with less than a complete remission. And this was confusing in a way to us as investigators, because one can imagine that a proportion of patients on the other end of transplant may have had residual disease, which then raises the question of how to interpret what the data will show. The patients post-transplant were not imaged uniformly before receiving brentuximab vedotin for a variety of logistical reasons. So it's impossible to know how many patients had disease after transplant and how many did not. But certainly patients with disease after transplant would be much more consistent with the patients you would see on the phase 2 study, essentially refractory to transplant or progressed post-transplant, rather than in the Athera study where you're looking at trying to improve cure rates for patients with brentuximab vedotin in this setting. That being said, the difference in progression-free survival in the Athera study, which was initially presented with 2 years and now 5 years, continues to maintain a significant difference in relapse and progression-free survival in favor of the arm of patients who got brentuximab vedotin of anywhere between 15 to 20%. That's also important to note. There's no overall survival benefit in that study, but that's not entirely unexpected, as the vast majority of patients who were on the placebo arm upon progression likely received and did receive brentuximab vedotin.
So what's this patient's current situation?
So he elected to receive brentuximab vedotin maintenance post-autologous stem cell transplant, and he is currently on his ninth cycle of treatment. He has had difficulty with neuropathy, and that is not entirely surprising. Post-autologous stem cell transplant in 1 year of therapy with brentuximab vedotin as part of this study did have a higher incidence of peripheral neuropathy. That being said, he remains in remission at this time and is doing well.
So I was going to ask you, as you were presenting the case, when you first talked about him relapsing, what your strategy is nowadays in terms of bridge to transplant, and particularly in a patient like this with a pretty early relapse, are there situations where you use novel agents, either be vedotin, checkpoint inhibitor, or both as a bridge to transplant?
Yeah, so patients who have an early relapse within 1 year, I tend to favor using novel agents, and there's a variety of strategies in which to do that. Brentuximab vedotin has been combined with chemotherapy, for example, with ICE in both a lead-in period as well as in a combination, as well as with other drugs such as bendamustine. And these have shown very good results in terms of achieving a complete remission. Alex Herrera has published a paper and presented at ASH the data in combining brentuximab vedotin and checkpoint inhibitor, in this case, nivolumab, in patients with first salvage. And we participated in that study. And the response rates and complete response rates were consistent with what we would expect with chemotherapy, but also with a very manageable side effect profile, I think, in comparison to chemotherapy as well. So in patients who have essentially refractory disease, I favor incorporating these novel agents and often consider bendamustine brentuximab combinations or brentuximab nivolumab combinations, if possible, either ideally on study, but if not on study, even potentially as clinical standard care.
So I'd like to hear about a case of a patient who received immunotherapy. You wrote up this 27-year-old woman. It looks very interesting, but also pretty complicated. But then you also mentioned this other patient that sounds really interesting. I'd like to hear about this other one, the patient who had this problem with hepatitis related to checkpoint therapy. How old was this patient and what happened?
So this is a 45-year-old male who actually was very heavily pretreated. He was initially diagnosed in 2004 and had ABVD, ICE, salvage therapy, autologous stem cell transplant after relapse. He actually went on to have numerous other therapies, including 2 rounds of brentuximab vedotin. He was on an everolimus protocol and had a response to this, but not for long. He's been on gemcitabine, navalbine, actually over 7 lines of therapy. So a very heavily pretreated young man who presented with recurrent disease, and this was biopsy proven, and actually went on the original analysis for nivolumab in the phase 2 study. He received 4 cycles of therapy with nivolumab and had a complete response almost immediately. You could feel his adenopathy shrink. And after 2 cycles, imaging studies confirmed that he was in a CR. After the 4th cycle of therapy, he was found to have significantly elevated AST and ALT in the thousands, actually. And he interestingly also had significant arthritis, which initially presented after the 3rd cycle of therapy, then got worse after the 4th cycle. And he had an inflammatory reaction around his port, which was also interesting. We had to remove this. He had a very erythematous, non-infectious inflammatory reaction around his port at that time. So we removed this and we started him on high-dose steroids, 1.5 milligrams per kilogram. And he had improvement in his LFTs, but it took a very long time for his LFTs to normalize. We did a very slow taper because as we tended to taper him, and I think we started around 120 milligrams, we started with inpatient hospitalization with solumedrol and then transitioned him to prednisone. But as we tapered him, his LFTs would periodically increase with periodic tapers. And we actually had to start him on concurrent CellCept as well as prednisone to control his AST, ALT elevations. But ultimately, after about 4 to 6 months of steroid and CellCept therapy, his LFTs had normalized and were able to taper him off these 2 agents. Since that time, I was not comfortable retreating him with checkpoint inhibitor given the aggressiveness of his toxicity. But he impressively has not required therapy. It has been now 4 years and he remains in remission. His subsequent course has been complicated by hypothyroidism and hypophysitis with replacement of testosterone and other hormones through endocrinology. But his most recent PET scan, done approximately 8 months ago, indicates that he remains in remission. This is the longest remission he's ever had with any therapy, and he's been heavily pretreated. Obviously, he raises the question of what this means, and the truth is, we don't know at this point. It's still, I think, early to say definitively, but it's an impressive response, both from an activity point of view, but in his case, the toxicity as well was one of the most striking I had ever seen with checkpoint inhibitor therapy.
So that case only prompts about 75 questions I'd like to ask you, but let me just pick a few because, wow, I mean, it was really amazing. First, I was actually just reflecting back on the fact 2014. I mean, that was before all the craziness with lung cancer and bladder cancer. That was, you know, it seems like it's only 4 years ago, but I'm just kind of curious, what was it like when you treated him in 2014 and saw the tumor go away?
Yeah, well, there are instances when you get the wow effect and you know when a drug is a very active drug. And he had palpable supraclavicular and axillary adenopathy. I would say after the first dose and maybe well before the second dose, you could see that his tumor had visibly shrunk and he felt very, very good. He was mildly symptomatic with sweats. And for him, pruritus was a huge issue, which is not uncommon in Hodgkin's. The pruritus and the B symptoms completely resolved after the first cycle. And his adenopathy went from 2 to 3 centimeter adenopathy that was clearly palpable to sub-centimeter adenopathy that you would have not considered pathologic after the first dose. So that was a wonderful feeling for him and myself to watch that happen to him. I think he was actually initially interested in considering restarting checkpoint inhibitor therapy based on his limited options. I was uncomfortable and said that, well, if you relapse, we would consider retreatment. But fortunately for him, he has not relapsed this far out.
So another thing I was just kind of curious about, when Hodgkin sort of burst onto the checkpoint scene, so to speak, it became evident that there were, at least in the tumor, this man has issues, I think, in terms of the immune system we can talk about. But in terms of the tumor, the thing that came out was this idea of like what was going on in the tumor, and particularly this amplification of PD-L1. I think it's 274.
Yeah. So Hodgkin's lymphoma almost uniformly expresses PD-1 antigen on its surface. And this is reflective generally of a amplification of the 9P24 gene, which is the PD-L1 and PD-L2 gene in that region. Interestingly, the correlation in the checkpoint inhibitor studies, the CheckMate studies, suggests that the greater the amplification, the greater the potential benefit to checkpoint inhibitor therapy. However, I think this requires further confirmation. You know, the Reed-Sternberg cell is a multinucleated cell, and the tumor biology is heterogeneous. These are within the microenvironment of Hodgkin's. The tumor cells compose often less than 3% of the tumor. 97 to 99% of the tumor is normal cells. So, and when you look at an individual tumor, there is a proportion of cells that will be positive for 9P24 amplification, copy gain, disomy, and how that biology is reflected in expression of PD-1 and PD-L1 is critical to be in understanding the nature of the activity of this drug. That being said, the vast majority of patients do respond to checkpoint inhibitors in the relapse refractory setting. About 65 to 70% of patients respond. And at this time, I don't use copy numbers to determine whether or not to give checkpoint inhibitors. I think that story still has to evolve to make an assumption about who we should and should not treat. But that being said, it's to this point the most interesting biomarker for who may benefit from PD-1 inhibitor therapy.
Were you able to get a copy number on this patient?
It's a great question. I don't believe that we have a copy number on him. However, the majority of patients with Hodgkin's lymphoma will be amplified, depending on how you count this. So in the studies that looked at it, in the CheckMate studies, the way that it was evaluated was that if patients had amplification within the tumor, it was considered amplified. So if you looked at X number of Reed-Sternberg cells and you found at least one with amplification, it was considered amplified. whether that's the correct way to gauge the biology of the tumor is unclear. So based on that methodology, it's not surprising that the majority of patients were counted as copy gained or amplified.
So I don't know whether it's because people tend to present cases like this or that there really is a correlation between autoimmune toxicity and benefit, but what do we know about that question?
Yeah, so there hasn't been a clear-cut correlation that I have observed. There are patients, obviously, that do very, very well without autoimmune toxicity. But on the other hand, there are patients certainly with autoimmune toxicity that don't do well, and that's because in many cases, we cannot continue therapy. And there are instances where, while we don't know how many cycles is enough, that patients largely who have partial responses and have to discontinue therapy because of toxicity clearly progress. So I've had patients with less than CRs have autoimmune toxicity. So I would consider that the development of autoimmune toxicity doesn't necessarily indicate that you will have a better or more durable response. However, I think the best predictive indicator of outcome is the ability to achieve a complete remission, regardless of toxicity. And that only occurs in a minority of patients. But those who achieve a CR, particularly those who achieve a CR earlier than later, in my experience, have done very, very well.
A couple of questions about the autoimmune problems this patient experienced. Did the patient have a liver biopsy? What did it look like? And what do you typically see when you see this? Is there anything characteristic?
Yeah, so this patient actually was quite ill, and we, you know, I think one of the critical features of a patient who has significant elevations in AST, ALT, and in his case also bilirubin when he presented, is to admit him to the hospital and start him on steroid therapy as a known side effect. So we didn't obtain a liver biopsy in this patient. However, I've had other patients with more modest increases in these liver enzymes who are relatively less symptomatic, in whom I have looked at liver biopsies. And I haven't found a characteristic microscopic finding that indicates to me that we have, say, T-cell infiltrates or a GVH-like picture that one might expect. Those are all things that we look for. And so there's no characteristic biopsy for this immune hepatitis.
Right. Another really unusual aspect to this case, I don't remember anybody ever describing what you were describing about the inflammatory changes around the port. What did it look like? Again, did you biopsy it? What do you think was going on?
Yeah, so I've never seen this before or after. This patient had an acutely swollen area around his port. It was mildly erythematous. It was painful to him. We immediately considered infectious causes. We actually removed the port and did biopsy the associated surrounding tissue and sent everything for culture. The cultures all came back negative, but what we found was a lot of granulation tissue and fibrotic tissue in that biopsy. But immediately upon removing the port, his symptoms improved. Of course, we were also simultaneously giving him steroids, and that may have contributed to that.
Interesting. You mentioned he had arthritis. Where was it? What was the clinical characteristics? Did he have any history at all of arthritis?
Yeah, so he did have complaints, not truly diagnosed arthritis, but he had a history of complaints of joint pain, knee pain, back pain. But after the third or fourth cycle, he did indicate that these symptoms had increased in severity, particularly in his knees and legs. I have also noticed in other patients, particularly those with bony disease, after the first cycle of therapy, bony pain, which then resolves prior to the second cycle. But this was different in his case. This was a slow but progressive worsening per his symptoms of his joint pain.
Interesting. And anytime I hear about hypophysitis, I always have to ask about it. Usually it's a melanoma case, but I'm curious, what was the clinical presentation? Did the patient have a headache? Did they get an MRI? What happened?
Yeah, so he actually had developed hypothyroidism and was evaluated by endocrinology. And at that time, he was found to be deficient in a number of hormones and found to have hypophysitis. So this was secondary to the finding of hypothyroidism, which we monitored for him, not only because he was on treatment with nivolumab, but historically he had received a multitude of therapies that could have also contributed to hypothyroidism. But he developed shortly after completing therapy and steroids, the thyroid dysfunction. So this was almost an incidental finding, but one that led to a diagnosis of hypophysitis.
Did you image his pituitary gland?
I did not, but endocrinology did. And
wow.
Yeah, they found findings consistent with this, though I don't know the details specifically.
Right. Why don't we finish out with the issue of limited stage disease? So when you were talking before about the various options with limited stage disease, as you went through that, I was thinking in my own mind, of course, every patient is individual, but generically, how do you approach the woman versus the man, the younger woman versus younger man with limited stage disease? And without getting into all the details about this 21-year-old woman, maybe kind of summarize the bottom line of what happened to her and kind of how you approach patients like her and how it differs if it's a man.
Yeah, so I think early stage disease, as I mentioned earlier, we have a variety of different platforms now. But I think in females, particularly those with mediastinal disease, there are considerations not only for curing the cancer, but also for minimizing their long-term risks. Because they are at higher risk for breast cancer, this becomes an important consideration when you talk about radiation therapy. You know, when I look at a patient who's young, I think it's important to consider not only where the disease is, but their outcomes from therapy with or without radiation, and their age, of course, as well. So in young patients in whom I'm concerned about hitting substantial breast tissue or heart, we have a discussion about whether we consider radiation therapy or chemotherapy alone. And, you know, there are now several studies, the RAPID study, the H10 study, and as I mentioned, even the RAFL study that looked at early stage disease. In the studies that try to omit radiation, I think what's consistently clear is that emitting radiation does increase the potential risk of a recurrence of the Hodgkin's lymphoma. And this is not a 20 or 30% increase, but anywhere from a 5 to 15% increase based on which study you look at and in which setting. There's no right or wrong answer, but the question is how much risk are you willing to take in that setting for the potential benefit down the line of avoiding secondary malignancies and cardiovascular disease and associated complications. So while a male has a lower incidence of breast cancer, he also still has lungs, he still has a heart, and these are all considerations I take into account in terms of when I talk to a male as well as a female, particularly in those patients who have disease in their chest. Those with largely axillary or cervical disease, then the avoidance of radiation, while still important, doesn't affect the risk necessarily of breast cancer or heart disease and may be more palatable in those patients. When I sit down with a young person, I do suggest that while there's an increase in relapse rate with avoidance of radiation, there's no difference in survival. And the vast majority of patients will be cured whether they receive radiation or they receive chemotherapy. And based on their imaging studies, one may consider anywhere between 3 to 6 cycles of therapy, as well as when you consider their risk stratification as to favorable and unfavorable. So I sit down with the patient, I consider where their disease is, I consider their risk profile, whether they have favorable disease or unfavorable disease, and then we have a frank discussion about the benefits of radiation, which largely include tumor control, but not survival, versus omission of radiation and chemotherapy, which have the benefits of avoiding secondary malignancies and cardiovascular toxicity with some loss of tumor control without a survival disadvantage. And the lack of survival disadvantage is largely based on the fact that these patients can be salvaged in the second line setting. So the majority of my patients after this discussion have used radiation, I would say, less and less. But in this young female who had a multi-station disease, so she had more than 3 sites of nodal disease, which makes her high risk, though she did not have bulk. We had this discussion, and after 2 cycles of ABVD chemotherapy, she was PET negative. Based on our discussion, she was inclined to pursue chemotherapy alone and avoid radiation. Radiation has a higher rate of secondary malignancy and other toxicities the younger you are. So the risk is slightly different for someone who's over the age of 35, as opposed to someone who's 19 or 21, like this person. So based on all of those factors, she elected to receive 6 cycles of chemotherapy because she has early unfavorable Hodgkin's lymphoma based on nodal sites.
Why six cycles when she was PET negative after two?
Yeah, so there are two studies, and the one that specifically addressed favorable versus unfavorable was the H10 study. It is also the study that has the best control arm of the group. And when they looked at unfavorable disease, they were treated with six cycles of therapy. And so I tend to follow that paradigm in my patients, though you could argue for four cycles based on the rapid study as well. But I felt that she had slightly higher risk disease. It's important to note in the rapid study, the vast majority of patients would have been considered favorable in the H10 study. So over two-thirds of patients, or roughly two-thirds of patients, if you use the EORTC criteria for prognostication, would have been considered favorable. So there was different populations being addressed in these two studies. And the rapid study also counted PET negativity to be Deauville 1 or 2. And in my practice, Deauville 1, 2, or 3 are typically considered PET negative. So there are slight variations between all these studies that make it, frankly, very complicated. But in general, based on the H10 study, I would offer this patient six cycles of therapy.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Hodgkin Lymphoma Update.